I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. President Trump's intelligence team, FBI Director Christopher Wray, CIA Director Gina Haspel, Lieutenant General Robert Ashley, the Director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, testified this week before the Senate Intelligence Committee about the foreign policy threats the country faces. Here's a bit of what Coates said in an edited clip.
We expect Russia will continue to wage its information war against democracies and to use social media to attempt to divide our societies. We currently assess that North Korea will seek to retain its WMD capabilities and is unlikely to completely give up its nuclear weapons and production capabilities because its leaders ultimately view nuclear weapons as critical to regime survival. Iran maintains the largest inventory of ballistic missiles in the Middle East. And while we do not believe Iran is currently undertaking activities we judge necessary to produce a nuclear device, Iranian officials have publicly threatened to push the boundaries of JCPOA restrictions if Iran does not gain the tangible financial benefits it expected from the deal. While ISIS is nearing territorial defeat in Iraq and Syria, the group has returned to its guerrilla warfare roots while continuing to plot attacks and direct its supporters worldwide. ISIS is intent on resurging and still commands thousands of fighters in Iraq and Syria.
Their analysis conflicted with what President Trump had said about Russia, North Korea, ISIS, and Iran, and he wasted no time criticizing them, calling them passive, naive, and wrong, and suggested they go back to school in a series of tweets. We asked Phil Ewing to join us. He's National Security Editor for NPR, joining us from the studios of NPR. Phil Ewing, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. What has been the response of the intelligence community to the president's tweets, if anything?
Well, the intelligence community very seldom talks itself in these types of situations because it strives as much as it can publicly to be apolitical or non-political. But the director of national intelligence, who we just heard from in that clip, kind of anticipated that this might happen. And he told members of Congress on Tuesday, look, we're not in the politics business. What I tell, what Coates tells people inside what they call the IC, the intelligence community, is to come into work and do your job and let the politics play out above your heads on the surface while you stay underwater and focused on what you need to focus on. But former intelligence officials, the former acting director of the CIA, and their advocates in Congress, including the vice chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, which convened this hearing earlier this week, they both defended the work of the intelligence community, and they said it's irresponsible for the president to belittle the professionals in the intelligence world because they're out there, as one member of Congress said, risking their lives every day to bring these insights to the president and other policymakers. This isn't just politically inconvenient agitprop that they're turning up to try to embarrass him. And this tension has always existed since the president has been in office, since the beginning of his term, and it probably will continue to go forward just because that's the style of governance that he's chosen.
Well, and I'm sure there are presidents, and including this president, who have disagreed privately with their intelligence team. But how unusual, even surprising, even shocking to have a president so publicly not just criticize, but really demean and belittle his own team that he picked.
It shows you how much the world has changed in terms of what is permissible or what the state of play is inside of Washington. A lot of people remember many years ago, President Bush 43 basically subsuming a lot of his authority as president politically to General David Petraeus, who was a top commander in Iraq at the time, saying, if General Petraeus says we need a surge in Western Iraq, then we're going to have a surge, and General Petraeus will be the one who tells me whether or not this surge was successful, and putting all of that political credibility in the hands of the Pentagon, the Army, the Defense Department, and Petraeus personally, because it was important to have someone who he believed voters and the American people viewed as credible to make those decisions to be making them. President Trump has taken a completely different tack. He pursues policies, national security policies, foreign policies, based on what he thinks is right or correct or what he thinks is the best course, separate and apart from the counsel that he's getting oftentimes in public from his national security and intelligence leaders. The Defense Department says ISIS isn't defeated. The United States needs to maintain a long-term commitment in Syria to help local forces there, especially Kurds, defeated completely. The president says no, it's defeated and we're going to withdraw American troops. Now, the actual policy that's being undertaken isn't clear. There wasn't as quick of a withdrawal of American forces as many of us expected when the president first made that announcement. But still, that political daylight continues to exist between him and his top military commanders. And that's true on these other issues. It's true about Syria. It's true about foreign interference in American elections. And it's true about something that even is kind of outside of the intelligence world, the matter of climate change, which the president is skeptical about. He kind of mocked the idea of climate change this week, given the cold temperatures across much of the United States. But in the National Intelligence Strategy that Director Coates just unveiled this month, it talks about the changes that the IC expects to take place around the world, from rising oceans and disease and the effects that that it expects will be results from the changing climate around the world.
But when you have a president and his own intelligence team that have such different and in many ways contradictory analyses of various threats that they see around the world, how does that get resolved? And what is the kind of message that gets sent to the rest of the world?
It may not get resolved. The president appears to have made the choice that irrespective of whether, for example, Iran is complying with the terms of the nuclear deal, which the intelligence community says it is, he still thinks it's good policy for the United States to withdraw from the nuclear agreement, for example. He still wants to punish it or impose restrictions and sanctions for other reasons because of other mischief that it gets up to around the Middle East, just as one example. So we may live in this world from now going forward where the IC and the defense establishment says one thing, but the president does another thing because he believes that second course is the right one.
Well, let me pick up on Iran because Gina Haspel, who's head of the CIA, and this is not a direct quote, but she seemed to indicate, and I think we heard this from Coates as well, is that the leaders in Iran, while they have ballistic missile capabilities, have not restarted or started their nuclear program, but they are frustrated that they haven't gotten the kind of economic benefits that were promised under the Obama administration. Can you flesh that out for us?
That's right. The strategic calculation with the Iran deal always was the Iranian regime and the Iranian economy would get some benefit from the relief of sanctions imposed by the U.S. and Europe and the other parties, and that in exchange for that, it was worth it from the perspective of the United States and the West to guarantee, as the Obama administration viewed, that there would be no nuclear weapon that could come out of the Iranian enrichment program. The president and his administration, the National Security Advisor, Mr. Bolton, and others all argue that that was the wrong trade-off to try to make, that giving economic strength to Iran, helping its economy, helping its regime with including trade deals with European businesses and even some cash payments by the United States, which the president and his supporters have made much of, was the wrong choice because even without a strategic weapon, Iran, in this view, is still a malign influence across the Middle East. And by enabling that behavior, the United States has destabilized the region instead of making it more stable. And so they just have taken the opposite view of the same coin as President Obama and his advisors. However, as you heard in that tape, Director of National Intelligence Coates, the CIA director, Gina Haspel, they say that in terms of the letter of the law, Iran is still abiding by the terms of this deal. And so what the president's decision has done has created a little bit of awkwardness with the other parties to the nuclear agreement, the Europeans, the Russians, and those other nations that were a part of these negotiations, because they still want to have these business relationships with Iran. They still want to normalize their dealings with Iran in a way that the United States has not and will not under Trump, because the president, the National Security Advisor, John Bolton, they want to continue to keep up those pressures even if the Iranians are complying technically with the terms of the nuclear deal.
I'm curious whether this intelligence team, and these are all, you know, the big players here, whether when they looked around the world at foreign policy threats, did they see threats coming across the U.S.-Mexico border?
That was not a priority of the many threats they laid out this week at the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing, and it was one of the areas in which there's daylight between them and the president. And to be clear, the DNI, Mr. Coates, talked about how transnational criminal organizations, as the IC calls them, are problematic for the United States. They engage in smuggling. They bring in contraband, drugs, human trafficking and so forth, but the Mexico border security issue was not described along the terms of the way the president describes it, as a crisis, as something urgent that requires some kind of extraordinary assertion of powers by him, which was another bit of daylight between where DNI Coates and the intelligence leaders are and where the president is. When you hear the president talk about this, he talks about a crisis. He wants to use his powers under the law to declare an emergency and move money around within the federal government without the authorization of Congress in order to be able to build this border barrier that he says needs to be in place between the United States and Mexico. And although the intelligence community would never say that smuggling and drug trafficking isn't a security problem for the United States,
sure,
it's not one of the big four. It's not a top one, according to them.
We have learned that President Trump had a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. There were no Americans present, and apparently the government, the administration, others in the administration did not even know that this meeting took place. What is the assessment or response, or has there been a response from the intelligence community to this off-the-record meeting?
Well, one thing we know from this hearing this week is there has been some response or assessment, but in classic intelligence fashion, we don't know what that is. Coates was asked about this, these reports about this pattern the president has apparently engaged in where he talks with Putin but then tries to minimize the readouts from those conversations getting out inside the administration. And Coates said, yes, that's a very sensitive subject. We need to talk about that in our closed session. There were two hearings on Tuesday before the Senate Intelligence Committee, the one that was public, which many of us watched on C-SPAN, and then a classified one in which the members of Congress and these intelligence witnesses could talk more freely about classified matters. I presume that that was a subject that took place behind closed doors because of the answer that Coates gave, but we don't right now know what he said or know what the IC really thinks about this pattern of behavior that's been described by The Washington Post and The New York Times, where the president has these conversations with Putin and then no one on the U.S. side knows actually what happened. The Americans, according to these reports, have to rely on what they intercept from the Russian side through emails or phone calls or other forms of spying to learn what Putin has told the Russians that they talked about.
Phil, we're almost out of time here, but there is an upcoming meeting, I'm not sure the date, between North Korea and the United States, with the two leaders meeting once again. Anything we should know about how the intelligence community looks at North Korea in 30 seconds or less? Sorry about that.
Well, the DNI said this week that he doesn't think the North Koreans would ever give up their nuclear weapons because they view them as essential to the survival of their regime. But as I mentioned earlier, the president's going to go ahead with what he wants to do anyway. He wants to have a second summit with Kim Jong-un and continue these negotiations because he thinks he can make personal progress with the regime. So we'll just have to see. We expect that will take place next month sometime somewhere in Asia.
Well, Phil Ewing, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times, getting our conversation started as we talk about some foreign policy challenges around the world.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And again, he is National Security Editor for NPR, joining us from their studios. We have another guest who will be joining us after this very short break, and we'll be talking about Venezuela, the crisis in Venezuela, and the role that the U.S. is playing there as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Venezuela is in crisis. Its economy is in shambles. Millions have left the country. People are hungry and have taken to the streets. Its last election has been called fraudulent, and Juan Guaido, opposition leader and head of the National Assembly, has declared himself the interim president, directly challenging self-proclaimed President Nicolas Maduro. The U.S., Canada, and countries in South America and Europe are standing with Guaido. President Trump's National Security Advisor John Bolton even hinted at sending 5,000 U.S. troops to neighboring Colombia. We asked Jeff Ramsey to join us. He is Venezuela researcher at the the Washington Office on Latin America. And Jeff Ramsey, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Are we talking about a failed state, Venezuela?
Well, it's pretty clear that the major democratic institutions in Venezuela have collapsed. The country is also in a deep economic crisis. People are suffering because they lack access to essential goods. and life-saving medication. I mean, people are dying because they don't have any access to things like antibiotics. So I would absolutely characterize the situation in Venezuela as a political crisis and a humanitarian one.
Absolutely. Talking about the election of last year, charges that it was fraudulent, there was voter intimidation, there was vote rigging. Can we say that Maduro was elected fraudulently to return as president of Venezuela?
I think we have to be very clear that the electoral process that was held in May of last year was neither free nor fair. There was a complete lack of checks and balances in the process itself. There were no credible domestic or international observers. And Maduro also got to pick and choose who he ran against. He actually prohibited the opposition umbrella group from participating and banned about half of the country's major opposition political parties. So it's a bit like me challenging the world's fastest swimmer to a race, except that he has to put on a series of extremely heavy weights, and also I get to be in a rowboat.
I understand what you're saying there. Tell us, who is Juan Guaido? What do we need to know about him? And I was doing a little bit of reading in preparation for the show. It seems like he was a student protester. He is certainly leading this opposition to Maduro. He's also the president of the National Assembly. But what do we need to know about him?
Well, he is a young, charismatic politician. He really did not have much of a national profile until 2 weeks ago.
Really?
He participated in student protests in 2007 and has been sort of a young, up-and-coming profile within the opposition. But really, in the last couple of weeks, he's exploded onto the national scene. He's united the opposition in a way that we haven't seen in years. And he's offering hope to Venezuelans that are optimistic for the first time in a long time that things could finally change.
What are his politics? And as you said there, people are, I'm sure, just out of many ways, out of desperation. What kind of support does he have? But more importantly, what are his politics? What does he want for his country?
Mm-hmm. Well, he has mostly focused on getting to some kind of transition. I mean, he's claiming to be legitimate interim president in Venezuela under an article of the Constitution that calls for elections to be convened in 30 days. So I think it's important that he has largely stuck to his role as interim president in calling for the creation of a transitional government and holding free and fair elections. I do think, though, that there is a risk of the opposition confusing democratic legitimacy with de facto power on the ground. In recent weeks, we've seen Guaido send ambassadors to the United States and elsewhere around the hemisphere. And I think that's really important. I think it's a form of signaling. It shows that the international community is united in calling for a return to democracy in Venezuela. But ultimately, I think there is a risk that the longer that the current situation, the current stalemate continues, that the opposition, this idea of Guaido as an interim president of a transitional government that is getting off the ground becomes much less credible and becomes something more like wishful thinking.
I mean, it sounds like you're saying that really the clock is ticking, that it cannot stand, cannot remain the way it is now, but the world is watching as these opposition organizations or individuals take their next steps.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, so there's been major protests around the country in the last 2 weeks. There's a huge rally planned for Saturday. There's been small-scale protests in major cities in recent days. And Maduro has responded by repressing the protesters. There are reports of at least 30 people dead as a result of clashes with security forces. Mm. And Maduro has actually the regime has actually jailed journalists, or at least detained journalists. There was an incident yesterday where the regime detained a Colombian journalist, and again, it highlights the gaps in diplomatic recognition of Guaido as this interim president. Because if you're the Colombian government and you want to provide consular services to a Colombian national that's been detained, you're going to want to reach out to the representatives of the Maduro regime. So whatever democratic legitimacy the representatives of Guaido have, to some degree, you're still going to want to contact and communicate with the people who have de facto power.
Sure. Sure. Let me just reintroduce you and also give out the phone number and ways to join our conversation. That is Jeff Ramsey. He's Venezuela researcher at the Washington Office on Latin America, obviously talking about what is happening in Venezuela now, the crisis there on many fronts. You can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. What do you make of the fact that the United States has recognized the interim president and also has there has been some indication or noises that the U.S. might be sending troops to neighboring Colombia. Let me ask you, Jeff Ramsey, just about the fact that the United States and Canada, other countries as well, has recognized this interim president. Are there any risks to the United States doing that? And I mean risks for Venezuela, knowing some of our history in South America.
Well, you know, I think that the U.S. needs to be mindful of its history in Latin America, which is obviously a very checkered past. And that's, you know, I think the rest of Latin America is absolutely mindful of that.
Right.
So I think, you know, to the degree to which this is framed by the Trump administration as some kind of conflict between you know, John Bolton and Nicolas Maduro, I think it's incredibly counterproductive, and it ultimately feeds the narrative of Maduro that he's the victim of some kind of imperialist plot. And in doing all of that, you know, I think there's a real risk of undercutting the agency of the Venezuelan opposition, which, as I said, has become much more organized, much more united than we've seen in a long time. And the truth is that Venezuelans themselves are tired of Maduro. They are plainly calling for new free and fair elections through which they can elect their own leader.
You mentioned John Bolton. He's the national security advisor to President Trump. And here's just a clip of him being interviewed on Fox Business News. And this was earlier this week.
We're in conversation with major American companies now that are either in Venezuela or, in the case of Citgo, here in the United States. I think we're trying to get to the same end result here. You know, Venezuela is one of the three countries I call the troika of tyranny. It'll make a big difference to the United States economically if we could have American oil companies really invest in and produce the oil capabilities in Venezuela. It'd be good for the people of Venezuela. It'd be good for the people of the United States. We both have a lot at stake here making this come out the right way.
Jeff, are we talking, is this all about oil?
Well, you know, I think we'd have to be naive to think that oil didn't factor into any of this. The truth is that Venezuela has the world's largest oil reserves. But you know, the U.S. is and has been for a long time the largest purchaser of Venezuelan oil. And in fact, on Monday, the United States announced new sanctions that would actually prevent the U.S. from purchasing Venezuelan oil. And it would also prevent the U.S. from exporting refined oil to Venezuela. So, I think in many ways it's a mistake to view this as a grab for Venezuela's oil, because Maduro would be happy to let the oil flow to the United States. And ultimately, you know, the fact that we've seen these broader economic sanctions, I think, is a real gamble. I think there is this idea from this administration that these oil sanctions are going to be some kind of silver bullet that's going to lead to a transition. And that's absolutely far from clear. But what we know is that these broader sanctions are going to have an impact on the Venezuelan people that are already suffering from a deep economic crisis. And that's because the oil industry accounts for about 80% of the hard currency that the Venezuelan state uses to pay for food and medicine imports.
Let me ask you about, it's sort of hard to know exactly what the message was, but much was made of the fact that National Security Advisor John Bolton had a legal pad, and the legal pad was turned out so there was some writing that was visible, including the word something like 5,000 troops to Colombia. Not sure what the message was, but if the U.S. sent 5,000 troops to Colombia, how would that be received in that part of the world?
Well, the Colombian government has already come out and clarified that they've had no offers from the United States to send such deployments, and it's far from clear that Colombia would actually accept any kind of deployments. I think the best reading of this is some kind of pressure tactic. I think there's no appetite within the Trump administration for real military intervention in Venezuela. And I think it's a very good thing. Any intervention in Venezuela would be a logistical nightmare, and it would be a bloodbath. But I think for some inexplicable reason, this administration sees value in saber rattling. There is this idea that if the U.S. saber rattles hard enough, that if, you know, they continue to threaten that all options are on the table, including a military one, that will somehow shake things loose and cause a split within Maduro's coalition, particularly within the armed forces. And the truth is that we actually haven't seen that. Even despite all the major ratcheting up of international pressure on Maduro in recent days, the military has stood firmly behind him. So again, I view these, the yellow notepad as part of a larger signaling strategy. But I have serious questions about whether that strategy is actually going to pay off.
What do you make of the fact that the Trump administration's new envoy to Venezuela is Elliot Abrams? And I remember him from the Reagan administration days back in the 1980s. He was supportive of the Contras, the death squads that worked in Central America. Also, I believe, involved in the failed coup against Hugo Chavez back in 2002. What is the message then coming from the administration that he is the new envoy to Venezuela?
Yeah, again, that goes back to the U.S. checkered past in previous interventions in Latin America. I think that, well, first, we're still not exactly clear on what this new role of special envoy to Venezuela actually will do. We have serious concerns that it undercuts the career diplomats at State Department. And it kind of bakes in a more politicized approach to Venezuela's crisis. And ultimately, it doesn't send a very positive signal to the rest of Latin America and the European Union. I mean, there is a broad multilateral consensus that Venezuela is in the midst of an authoritarian slide. And I think, characterizing this as some kind of Cold War 2.0 by nominating Elliot Abrams as the special envoy, I think sends the wrong message.
We have about 2 minutes before we have to end our conversation. So unfair to ask you this, but nonetheless, how does this end? Or if not that, what is the next move to bring some kind of stability, some kind of, frankly, democracy and help to the Venezuelan people?
Yeah, well, You know, I think that the as I said, you know, that this we've seen a ton of international pressure on the Maduro regime in recent days, and I think it's important. I also think it's important that pressure is kept as multilateral as possible. And I think that any kind of pressure, any kind of sanctions need to be tied to clear and concrete objectives on the ground and linked to the ultimate way forward, which is new elections. I think we've seen that largely. But I do think that the way to get there is through some kind of pacted solution, some kind of credible negotiated process. The tricky part is that the opposition has participated in talks with the Maduro regime before, right, and they've come out burnt every time because Maduro has used them to divide the opposition and buy time. But I think there's no appetite for the international community, nor among the opposition, to enter into any kind of hollow dialogue. I think we're likely to see some kind of negotiations process emerge in the coming days. And I think Maduro will be under tremendous pressure to make serious concessions.
Meaning stepping aside or allowing for new elections?
Yeah, I mean, again, the X factor in all of this is the armed forces in Venezuela. So far, they have stood behind Maduro, and they have said that they respect the Constitution, but they've also said that they support dialogue. And I think, you know, as I said, there's not going to be any kind of dialogue, any kind of credible negotiations that doesn't involve new elections. It's true that Maduro has strong incentives to try to buy time and hold on to power. But again, I'm hopeful that we'll see some kind of serious democratic negotiated solution to the crisis in the coming days.
Jeff Ramsey, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. After the short break, Afghanistan. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Could America's longest war be coming to an end? It's too soon to know for sure, but there is some optimism based on negotiations the U.S. has been having with the Taliban in Doha, Qatar. The framework, broadly speaking, calls for the U.S. to remove its forces in exchange for the Taliban promising that Afghanistan will not be a launching pad for terror attacks. President Trump recently ordered the withdrawal of 14,000 American troops from the country. The U.S. has been there for more than 17 years fighting a war that has cost $1 trillion. We asked Nick Schifrin to join us. He's foreign affairs and defense correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. And Nick Schifrin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. This seems like a story that's been a bit under the radar, Nick. How long have the U.S. and Taliban been having face-to-face talks?
This is by far the most serious talks that the U.S. and Taliban have had that have been on and off, I would say, for at least 8 years, to kind of go back to the U.S. surge in Afghanistan. And of course, there were some possible talks or some indirect talks that happened right after 9/11. So, you know, over the last 18 years, some U.S. officials and many international officials have believed that the only way to end this war was through a political negotiation, a political settlement. And what has happened to make this moment come is the determination, I would say, rather than the ordering per se, of President Trump to withdraw from Afghanistan. And that has allowed Zalmay Khalilzad, the ambassador there in the past under George W. Bush, and now the special envoy who's leading the U.S. talks, to finally convince the Taliban that, yes, the U.S. was serious about withdrawal. And that seriousness has allowed the Taliban then to discuss a few things. One, ceasefire, and two, talking directly with the Afghan government which is something that they've resisted, as well as the easier give for them, which is renouncing Al-Qaeda and other terror groups.
I mean, that seems so simple, especially something that's been negotiated or under negotiation for 8 years. The idea is that if you stop your terror attacks, we'll pull out of Afghanistan. Obviously, a much more complicated series of negotiations.
Yeah, it's in part complicated just because of getting the United States government to want to talk with an adversary that is launching attacks against U.S. troops in Afghanistan isn't easy. And two, it's been difficult for the Taliban to have any pressure on it, or it's rare for the Taliban to feel very much pressure. They have a safe haven in neighboring Pakistan, which has shielded or sheltered some of the senior leaders, and U.S. officials believe Pakistanis have also kind of fueled arms into the mid-level Taliban commanders in Afghanistan. And so the Taliban haven't felt too much of a need to give in and negotiate. There's an old saying that Zalmay Khalilzad actually has referenced, which is the Taliban, quote, you may have all the watches, but we have all the time. And the Taliban have been willing to wait the U.S. out. But I think people see the writing on the wall that this is the U.S. endgame and people want to shape it.
Where are the Afghan representatives in these peace talks? It sounds like it's the U.S. talking to the Taliban without the Afghanistan government?
Yeah, so this is one of the most sensitive topics of this negotiation. And as somebody who's part of the negotiation put it to me the other day, the easy part, so to speak, might be U.S.-Taliban agreements. The Afghan government, led by Ashraf Ghani, the president, and Abdullah Abdullah, a longtime critic of the Taliban and fighter of the Taliban back in the 90s, have resisted some of these talks because they want to be participants in it. They want to be in the middle of it. And they know that any deal with the Taliban would probably require the dissolution of the Afghan government and the creation of some kind of interim administration. So the U.S. is essentially asking the president of Afghanistan, the CEO of Afghanistan, to write themselves out of a job. Wow. And that may happen this year. So that's a very difficult ask. The Taliban have not wanted to negotiate directly with the Afghan government because they don't want to give it legitimacy. And so they've been willing to negotiate with the U.S. What is different now is the U.S. has been willing to negotiate with the Taliban to a pretty far down the road to get these kind of early agreements, I would call them, on some of these major issues. But the sticking point will be what the Taliban is interested and willing to do with the Afghan government, and then begins a long process, a very difficult process of figuring out what the future of Afghanistan is, where the Taliban is part of the government itself. And that's something that hasn't even started yet.
Well, and you've reported, as others have, is that 2018 was one of the deadliest years for the civilians in Afghanistan, and including increased attacks by the Taliban. So what kind of credibility do they have at a peace table?
Well, I mean, ironically, and I don't mean to diminish the violence, but ironically, the violence gives them credibility. And what I mean by that is that, you know, the United States has long said that we will push the Taliban to the negotiating table. We will exact so much pain on the Taliban, they will essentially be forced to negotiate. The Taliban have said the same thing, that we are going to push you out, or we are going to inflict pain on you that is unacceptable to you. And so in every negotiation, if you go back for decades, the ends of any of these wars coincide with an increase in violence. And so what we're seeing on the ground in Afghanistan is the Taliban targeting Afghan police, Afghan soldiers, and really trying to exert some pain to prove that they have leverage in this moment at the same time that they are negotiating with the United States. And what's interesting, I talked to one official who's part of the negotiations, and they said, look, they realize this violence is going on, but there's no real acknowledgement of it, simply because, you know, there's a consensus in the U.S. to try and make a political deal.
They do control large portions of Afghanistan. Do they want to then run the country the way they did before September 11th?
Yeah, so that's two interesting points. One, the Taliban do have influence. I think the new report out today from the Inspector General says something like control of 15%, contesting 35%. So let's say give or take about half the country. Wow. They either control or contest. And that number is higher than it was when I was living there, for example, in 2009, 2010, at the height of the U.S. surge in Afghanistan. So the Taliban influence has not gone down. Quite the contrary, it's gone up. And so what does that mean for negotiations with the Afghan government? There's a real question as to how much control the Afghan government has and how much ability it has to control its own territory. And so there will be a negotiation between the Afghan government and the Taliban over what the future government looks like. But the Taliban says they do not want total control. They do not want to revert back to pre-9/11 when they ran the country. And so what this looks like, it's unclear again, but some kind of negotiation which the Taliban ends up as part of the Afghan government or part of some kind of interim government, leading to, you know, what's called Loya Jirga, a big event with lots of elders and lots of people representing different aspects of the country, making a decision essentially as to what the future constitution would be and what the future government would look like.
Of course, we don't know the details of that, but I'm wondering about the status of women under whatever new government there will be. Of course, knowing what life was like for them living under the Taliban, are we going to see the clock rolled back, do you think?
Well, this is something that a lot of people are worried about. So we've had female activists, especially in the last 3 or 4 days, well-known Afghan women like Fawzia Koofi, who is an MP from the Northeast, talk about, hey, look, my district or my province in the Northeast used to be very safe. Now it's not. And I don't want to go backward. Right. As a woman, as a member of this province in the Northeast, and it feels like we're going backward, or she's worried that we're going backward. And so a lot of people, including the U.S. delegation, says that there are red lines. And one of those red lines will be the parts of the Afghan constitution that respect minorities' rights, respect women's rights. Again, we don't know what it's going to look like. And you know, Afghanistan has a history in which there have been certain areas of the country where rights are more respected than others. More urban areas, of course, have been more liberal in the past. And so, you know, you don't necessarily need to see what the political scientists who study Afghanistan have called like the cheddar cheese model or American cheese model, that it's one block. It can be more Swiss cheese. It could be, you know, divergent in different parts. But it's certainly something that a lot of people are concerned about. And the U.S. says that it wants to ensure those rights. But you know, there's a lot of people who are worried that the U.S. is basically rushing for the exits, to quote one critic, and will give up a lot of those hard-fought gains.
We have, what, 14,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan today?
Yeah, about the official number is about 14,000.
About 14,000. Assuming this goes forward and assuming that optimism is based on some kind of reality, is there a plan for the withdrawal of U.S. troops yet?
So what I can say is that U.S. officials tell me that they have discussed withdrawing as many as 7,000 troops, which is half, rather quickly. And so
within months or something like that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think maybe an announcement in less time than that. I mean, the actual pace of withdrawal is to be determined. But yeah, we're talking about months. And so the question is the timing. So the president, as we all saw, lots of reports in December, suggested that, raised that in December at the same time that he raised withdrawing Syria. And so this is obviously something that President Trump has talked about for quite a long time, including during the campaign, withdrawing from these efforts. What seems to have happened now, according to the officials I talked to, is that the president's still determined to withdraw, but has agreed to essentially allow the withdrawal discussion to be part of Zalmay Khalilzad's diplomatic efforts. And so Khalilzad, I'm told, has come control over what the withdrawal looks like and how fast it is. And that's important from his team's perspective because they want to be able to give and take with the Taliban. And so, for example, if there's some kind of full withdrawal promise that is 12 months, 18 months, 24 months, maybe even longer, that Khalilzad can offer to the Taliban, how far are the Taliban willing to go in return? Hmm. Will they offer a complete ceasefire or a staged ceasefire, that kind of thing? So the fact is that I think the U.S. establishment, led by the president, is gearing toward withdrawal, but the details of that, at least as of now, seem to be part of these negotiations. But as we know, the president can always give a speech or send a tweet, and things might change.
Well, as we all know, U.S. troops have been there since shortly after September 11th, 2001. I think the price tag so far is something like $1 trillion. Can you imagine, or what would Afghanistan, without a U.S. military presence, what that country would look like?
Well, look, there's a lot of people in Washington, where I live, who are worried and are convinced the day U.S. leaves Afghanistan, the state collapses. And I think that there's evidence to suggest that the Afghan military, the Afghan security forces, would struggle to hold together, would struggle to fight on their own. And, of course, the Afghan government might teeter, according to one senior official, perhaps even more than teeter, yeah, if the U.S. gave up political support to the Afghan government. But that's not really what we're talking about. We're talking about reducing U.S. military presence. And there are other Afghan watchers who would argue, look, what's the difference between 14,000 or 7,000 or even 3,000 or 2,000 troops? There's likely going to be some kind of small presence allowed for counterterrorism operations against ISIS especially. And some kind of agreement between the Taliban, the U.S., and the Afghan government is inevitable. And so these people argue that Afghanistan is better off in the long run with less U.S. presence, because the only way to get to a political solution, which is the only solution to the war, they say, is to withdraw U.S. troops. So, again, devil's in the details. It depends on how it's done.
You mentioned ISIS. What, if any, is the relationship between the Taliban, ISIS, al-Qaeda, or whatever is left of al-Qaeda?
So I think we should probably distinguish those things. The Taliban and ISIS are enemies. They fight each other, they attack each other, they kill each other. I think that's quite clear. Al-Qaeda, there's a small number of al-Qaeda apparently in Afghanistan, according to the intelligence officials. There has never been a close relationship with the Taliban and al-Qaeda after 9/11. As we know, al-Qaeda mostly moved into Pakistan, and they've been really degraded over the years by U.S. drone strikes and Pakistani efforts as well. So the relationship with al-Qaeda is something that the U.S. wants Taliban to explicitly say, we renounce them and we renounce other groups. So that's very easy with ISIS. The Taliban are fighting ISIS. Al-Qaeda requires a kind of political declaration from the Taliban. But the reasons that the Taliban refused to give up Osama bin Laden after 9/11, namely that basically, Osama bin Laden was a guest in Afghanistan and Afghans don't give up guests, that pressure is gone. And so it seems to be relatively easy for the Taliban to declare that they are not aligned with al-Qaeda nor would ever support it again.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Nick Schifrin, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome. And he's foreign affairs and defense correspondent for the News Hour on PBS. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out more about the program. Also, how to download a podcast of the show, which is rather simple. You can also send us an email. You can sign up for our Facebook group and contact us throughout the day and throughout the night. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thank you so much for joining us.